Hello everyone, thanks very much for coming early on this morning for the third lecture of the machine learning course. So I think it will be good to review what have been done in the first week of this course. As I have mentioned in the first two lectures, the goal of supervised learning is to, given some data set of some data points and some labels, we want to fit some function so that we want to match the function applied on the data points to some given labels. So the data points could be like each data point could be a vector that has size dx. Well, dx depends on the context or our problem of interest. And x1, x2 could be, for instance, either pixels if we're dealing with images, or if we have spin configurations, x1 could be either plus or minus 1. Y could be labels, so y does not necessarily have to be a vector. So we could have, for instance, in the context of classification, either y equal to 0 or 1 if we have binary classification. Even if we have also regression, y could be a continuous number. And there are also cases where it's a good idea to consider y as a vector, and I'm going to talk about that later on today. Okay. And in the previous lecture, we have also seen two supervised learning algorithms. The first one is called linear regression. So from what the name suggests is that we use a linear model so that we can do regression if we have if we're given continuous labels. So the assumption we make is that we're making a linear kind of fit of the data points. And another model we studied is the logistic regression. So the name here, as I've mentioned last time, is a bit confusing because the purpose of this is to do a binary classification. So if you were given labels, for instance, that are binary, that are either 0 or 1 for a one-dimensional label, then logistic regression is helpful if you want to do a binary classification, assuming again that you have a linear model. Today, we're going to go beyond the linear assumption, and we're going to use nonlinear models. Specifically, we're going to use feedforward neural networks, also known as FFNNs. So if you see this, then that stands for a feedforward neural network. And we're specifically today, we're going to see how the architecture of this feedforward neural network. We're going to learn again, revise again the notion of weights and biases that we have seen last time. And we're going to also learn more about different possible activation functions that will be used in this architecture. And we're going to also touch upon a bit on the expressivity of the of these feedforward neural networks. And we're going to also talk a bit about some choices of the cost functions that we're going to use to train these architectures. Okay. So before going into the math of these architectures, I thought it would be a good idea to share few motivations so that you can connect with what I'm going to explain today in the Blackboard. Okay, and again, if something is not clear, please feel free to stop me. That would be really appreciated. Okay, so the first thing I want to highlight here is that this is like this survey that was done on this website called Kaggle. So this is a very famous website for data science, that where data scientists go to do some sort of competitions or benchmarks of different models in machine learning. And here, there is a survey of different architectures in machine learning. So there is a linear, in logistic regression. There are also other architectures we didn't have time to cover. So for instance, decision trees, random forests, other algorithms, gradient boosting machines, and also the ones that we're going to learn about in the next lecture is convolutional neural networks, dense neural networks. So the goal of this survey was to see the popularity and the uses of these architectures in the real world. Interestingly enough, you can see that linear and logistic regression are actually the most used models in the literature, in the real world applications. So despite being very simple, they are actually like very helpful in real world applications. So whenever you have an application, for instance, in many-body physics, it's a good idea to start using these architectures before we start using these more complicated models. So this is just one comment to highlight that it's always good to start simple. This is the intuition that that's a philosophy of like that we have in physics, to start from simple models. But one thing I highlighted last time is that, for instance, linear models, for instance, that logistic regression have a limitation. So if you remember from the last demo, in the last lecture, when we consider this XOR type data set, where we have two clusters of data, the one on these two sides and the other on these two sides, and we've seen that when we try to fit a logistic regression model on this data set, we have some sort of a linear decision boundary, which is clearly it's not possible to distinguish between the two classes using this linear decision boundary. So clearly we need a different way of doing this, and this is what neural networks can do. So we'll see that we can actually draw nonlinear decision boundaries when we have these types of data sets. So as a historic architecture, remember from the first lecture, I mentioned that neural networks actually exist since the 70s. And they were known in literature, and like there was a lot of research going on there. But the breakthrough moment when these architectures became very famous was the moments in 2012 that I've mentioned in the first lecture, where a neural network architecture managed to beat all the previous approaches in terms of image classification. And currently, neural networks, for instance, ChatGPT, are doing actually wonders in the field of natural language processing and beyond. And so potential, like as I've mentioned, there are applications in terms of image classification and also natural language processing. And the question that we might ask is why neural networks are very useful now, and why not they were not useful back at the time. So there are a lot of arguments that one might argue about why this haven't happened in the past few years. And one potential reason is related to the fact that we are in the era of big data. So back at the time, like few decades ago, we didn't have big data. So basically linear models and traditional architectures in machine learning were enough to do the job that we wanted to do. But as we got more data, and as the tasks that we wanted to do become more challenging, more demanding, we need actually to build more advanced models compared to the linear models, such as the ones we've seen in the previous two lectures. So, and this is like why you see that the analogy here is that the larger the neural network that we're going to build, the better the performances that we have. Okay, so this is one of the motivation behind that could explain. Yeah, go ahead.
What is the plateau?
Yeah, so this is like, thank you for reminding me about this point. So the idea is that, well, if you use a linear model, and if you feed in like a very large data set, as we've seen, like the linear models only draw linear decision boundaries. So at some point you'll see that the accuracy that you get will saturate. It will not go up by enlarging the size of your, like enlarging the number of your examples that you have in your data set. So clearly, if you want to improve your performance, you need to go beyond like linear models, which is the case, for instance, of neural networks, which offer a nonlinear way of handling these data points. So this is why you see, for instance, same thing for a small neural network. A small neural network has like limited expressivity. So if you throw in like an even bigger data set, you'll see that the accuracy will saturate. So you'll need to build a better, a larger neural network so that you get a better accuracy, and so on and so forth. You see the idea?
Yeah. By expressibility, you mean like if I have any sort of random set of data to start with, I should be able to get a good classification. Is that?
Yeah. So that's the idea.
Linear methods, it's clear why that doesn't work, but then the more random your data set is, in some
sense, the more you need, like the more expressive you need, like the more parameters you would need, so that you can like kind of handle your data set of interest. Okay, and So now I just wanted to mention a brief motivation about the motivation behind like the use of artificial neural networks. So those networks are actually biologically inspired from our brain, which have a very large number of neurons, and where each neuron also communicates with another large number of neurons, where we have kind of you can see that each neuron is connected through other neurons, and each neuron is sending some sort of a signal, as you can see from this plot. I'm not expecting you to see that, like, to understand the details. I just wanted to draw an analogy between the biologically inspired neurons, which we don't understand fully yet, and the artificial neural networks that we're going to see today. And so from this analogy, we can describe like a simplified model for an artificial neuron. So one artificial neuron model here is the one that could describe, for instance, or could predict the probability that a certain phone is a top seller. So for instance, this neuron will receive two other signals from other neurons. So the first signal will be the price of that phone, which is clearly an important factor. And the other factor is a brand. So clearly that's also an important factor when someone wants to purchase a phone. So if we want to draw this probability, what we can do is take that first input, which is a price, and also the second input, and multiply them with some trainable parameters, which we call weights. And we could add a bias and also use a nonlinear activation so that we can get a prediction. So that's the simple example. We have also seen this for the logistic regression, which is something very similar. So if we do an example, for instance, of a phone that has a very large price, 500, it's okay, we will drop the currency. And let's assume that the brand X2 is like one. This means like a very good brand. So if we use this here, then we'll find that so assuming that the bias is zero, then we'll have the sum here will be negative. It will be actually positive if you check. And for here, you'll find that the sum provided here will be negative. So in that case, the prediction that this neuron gives is that it's more likely that someone will buy this phone compared to this phone, which is reasonable for some people, but not for others. So this is just one model for how we can predict the probability of this certain property. So this is one example, this is a simplified picture. We can actually build something more complicated out of this small example. So let's say we want to do the same thing, predict the probability that a phone is a top seller. So we need to consider other factors beyond this. So important factors are awareness of people about this phone, the affordability of this phone, and also the technical specs of this phone, which are also somehow related to other sort of features. For instance, the price, the marketing that the company does on this phone, the shipping cost, the speed, the camera quality, brand. So those are just examples. Of course, there are more features that we can think about. And the idea is that these kind of simpler features that were obtained from these preliminary features can be actually obtained by doing connections between this first layer and the second layer of features. So this kind of will explain the notion of a layer more intuitively in this example. So for instance, the notion of affordability is connected to the price and the shipping costs. The idea of awareness of the phone could be connected to marketing and also about the brand. The technical specs could be related to features like speed, camera quality. And by doing that, then we can actually build an idea about these more simplified features that would allow us to provide a better estimation of the probability that the phone is a top seller. Okay, so this will clarify the example of, or the notion of a layer later on. And here I also wanted to provide a simplified example for the notion of activation. So when we combine, for instance, marketing and brand to provide awareness, and we multiply them with a bias, multiply with the weights and add a bias and use nonlinear activation functions, the results we will get, or the score we will get for awareness will be called activation. So these kind of numbers that we will get will be called activations. And this simple example is nothing but a simplified version of feed-forward neural networks, where we have learnable connections. So the connections we make between different numbers that we have here, which we also call neurons, are actually learnable. So the parameters we do can be trainable. And the activations we get are actually learnable features. So you remember last time when we had the logistic regression, in order to learn, like in order to do like to draw like a nonlinear decision boundary, we needed to add other features to the inputs. So we needed to do the products of x1 and x2 so that we can draw a nonlinear decision boundary. So here, the idea of feedforward neural networks is to drop feature engineering, meaning that we will assume that we don't know what are the relevant features, and we will let the model kind of learn these important features by itself by training training these connections, okay? Because we don't know what are these important features in advance. So we will let the architecture learn that by itself. And if you remember from last lecture, this architecture, if we drop the first layer, this architecture is nothing but logistic regression. So by building more layers before that layer, we're actually letting the architecture learn more advanced features that are relevant to make a better prediction. And for the feedforward neural network, which I'm going to explain more in a second, so we will have many layers. So we will have the first layer and the output layer, and we'll also have hidden layers. And each layer, we have different neurons, and each neuron is connected to all the other neurons in the next layer and also in the previous layer. And the number of hidden layers in the middle is a hyperparameter, so we could have as many layers as we want. And we could also define like a very large number of layers. So this motivates the naming of deep learning, because we could like define a very large number of layers so that our architecture is deep, and state-of-the-art results actually like often have like a very large number of layers in the scale of hundreds of layers. And before going to the math of feedforward neural networks, I wanted to provide an simple example of how a feedforward neural network would be able to classify pictures of cats and dogs. So if you remember, like from the context of supervised learning, we need a data set, which is a set of lots of pictures of cats and dogs with their labels. So what we can do is choose a certain neural network architecture, for instance, a feedforward neural network, where at the output we have two neurons. The first neuron corresponds to the probability of getting a cat, and the second one corresponds to the probability of getting a dog. And for the picture, we can divide it into multiple pixels, and for instance, the value of the first pixel will be fed into the first neuron, and so on and so forth, until the last pixel will be fed into the last neuron. So what we can, and the idea is that as we progress through more layers, the first layer will focus on more fine-grained details. And for instance, as we go into more depth into the feedforward neural network at the end, at the last layers, we will hopefully like get into the bigger picture into the larger features of the picture, for instance, the face and the legs, so that we can make a better prediction about whether that's a cat or a dog. So this is just about hand-wavy arguments. So now, in order to kind of teach the neural network, or the better term is train the neural network, we need to feed these architectures to the neural network, and that will result initially. So this is a picture of a dog, and initially we might get a wrong prediction. So the neural network might say, well, it's a cat. That's wrong, so we need to correct that. So to do this, we need to use an algorithm called backpropagation that we will learn about hopefully today. So, sorry. So backpropagation consists of like backpropagating the error from the output layers to the from the output layer to the previous layer and so on and so forth, so that we kind of tune the couplings in such a way that next time we feed in the same picture, we get the correct prediction. So that's the idea. Instead of seeing the
What's the meaning of the red line and blue line in the?
Yeah, can you say that again? Yeah.
What's the meaning of the red line and blue line in the?
Oh yeah, so what I meant here by like red lines are basically the previous values of the learnable of the parameters, mm-hmm. and blue lines correspond to the updates of the parameters using this backpropagation algorithm that I'm going to learn about. Yeah, and I'm going to show you in the hopefully today. So after doing this backpropagation, hopefully we'll get the correct results. And the math of doing this this backpropagation and forwarding each individual picture into feedforward network is what we're going to see hopefully on the blackboard with more details on the math. Okay, so hopefully that will give you like at least an intuitive picture about the motivation behind feedforward neural networks and why they will be useful for reward applications. Okay. So are there any questions so far about this brief motivation? Yeah.
As you increase the size of the network, what happens to the cost of training?
Yeah, so your question is like if we increase the number of like layers or number of neurons.
You've got a much bigger data set, so if your data set goes up by a factor of 10, how much longer does it take to train the model?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer to this is like actually varies from one architecture to the other. So an answer for the feed-forward neural network will vary, for instance, for the convolutional neural network that we will learn about later on. So it's really like architecture dependence. But the intuition that we have is that the larger the data set, the more like the larger the model that you would need to handle this data set. But that's a great question. Yeah. Okay. So now after I've shown you like the feedforward neural network in a very quick manner, I wanted now to focus on the details so that you can actually connect with what I have shown you on the slides. So as I've mentioned, the feedforward neural network consists of like an input layer where we have our input or our for each data point we have basically a tuple of values that we feed in to the neurons on the input layer. So these values would correspond to the values that we have for each data point. And then at the end, we will have an output layer. And for instance, if we have different classification, the size of the output layer would correspond to the number of classes that we have in our data set. Another ingredient is then the hidden layers. So we could have as many hidden layers as we want. So that's a hyperparameter. So for instance, here we have two hidden layers, but that could vary from one experiment to the other. And one observation that you can make here is that each neuron is connected to all the other neurons in the previous layer, and also to all the neurons in the next layer. So this motivates also one name of these architectures as a fully connected neural network, because each neuron is fully connected to all the other neurons. Okay, so the first thing I want to denote here is that each circle here is called an artificial neuron, or simply a neuron. And before going into like how we're going to feed forward this input into the output layer, I want to clarify some few notations so that we can go into the math of this forward pass. So we can define this number NL as the number of each neurons in each layer. So for instance, N0 would be the number of layers in the input layer, N1 will be the number of layers in the first hidden layer, and so on and so forth. So NL is number of neurons in layer L. And we can also define capital L as the largest value of small L, where L is the index of the layer. So in that example, L is equal to 3 because so the first input layer is by convention considered as layer 0, and the others start from 1 to 3. So in that example, we have capital A equal to 3, and another notation I want to make is the value of each neuron at a specific layer. So AJL, so if this is layer L, and if this is index J, so that will be AJL. So that's the value that we have in each neuron. So that will be the output from the Jth neuron and in layer L. Okay, so far so good. So this is the notation that we will use later on. And just by like looking here at the input layer, we can clearly see that if we are the first layer, which is L small equal to 0, then N0 has to be equal to the size of each data point. So clearly we need to have N0 equal to dx. So the size of the input layer has to be the same size as each data point. So that's something that's fixed by our data set. And the same thing, we need that the size of the output layer to be equal to the size of our each label. Or in other words, the number of classes that we will have. That this will become clearer later on about why dy will be the number of classes if we're in the context of classification. If we're in the context of regression, if y is only a number, then the output layer will just have one neuron at the end, okay? And another notation to clarify is that if we're again taking L equal, small equal to 0, then AJ 0 will be just the value of the data set of each data point at the jth index. Okay? And that holds from I from J going from 1 to the size of each data point. Okay? So far, so good. Okay? So now, as I've highlighted in that picture above, that each neuron is connected to all the other neurons in the previous layer and also in the next layer, so we're going to zoom in on this picture. So we're going to take one, we're going to take the jth neuron at the lth layer. So if we connect that to the previous layers, to the previous layer, like that will be layer L minus 1. So that that neuron will receive information from the neurons in the previous layer. So that will be AL minus 1, 1. So that will be the value of the first neuron in the previous layer, the value of the second neuron in the previous layer, until the value of the last neuron in the previous layer. So that will be, using the convention that we have here, ANL minus 1 at the layer L minus 1. Okay? So that will be on the left side. On the right side, this value, AJL, is actually sent to all the neurons in the next layer. So for all the neurons in the next layer, we're going to send the same value. So we're sending the same message to all the neurons in the next layer. OK? So is this picture clear so far? OK, so now since we are, as I've said here, since we're sending the same outputs, this is kind of similar to saying that, well, we have something that looks like that, where we send in one message, and where this one message depends on the values of the neurons in the previous layer. So we'll have A1, L minus 1, A2, L minus 1, until ANL minus 1 at the previous layer. So AJL is a function of all the values of the neurons in the previous layer. So that's how I want you to think about this. So if you want to write this into equations, so we will have first some sort of a sum over all the values of the neurons in the previous layer. So we'll have a sum from I equal to 1 to NL minus 1 of the values of the neurons in the previous layer. Okay? And that should be equal at the end up to some factors that I'm going to clarify in a second. That should give me at the end the value of the neuron at the jth index in the L layer. So by taking an analogy of what we have seen before in the logistic regression, we need some sort of weights and also biases. So one natural thing we could do here is to multiply by some weights parameter that would need to depend on the ith index and also on the jth index. So naturally, we'll have some sort of weight matrix. And additionally to that, we also need a bias that we can interpret as a vector that depend on the index j. So that naturally would make us add this parameter bj. And also by taking an analogy of what we have seen in logistic regression, it's a good idea to also apply what's called an activation function that would allow us to map this weighted sum of all the values in the previous neurons to get the output that we want over here. Okay? So is this clear so far about how we went from these inputs to the output here?
Okay. Sorry, so your input and output are all, for now, binary variables, right?
That's a great point, yeah. So the assumption we're making here that is that these values can be continuous. So we're not assuming that they are necessarily binary. So if you remember in the previous first lecture, I mentioned the architecture called the perceptron. So this architecture assumes that the values of the neurons is binary. Mm-hmm. So this is like the original formulation of neural networks. But in this formulation, we assume that the neurons are continuous. And there is a reason for this. That's because we want to do gradient descent so that we can allow for continuous learning.
But then I have a question. The figure that you showed before where you had some neurons activating, that was a perceptron, right?
Yeah, so this is like just an, yeah, that's a great point. So the we just, this is like kind of an analogy that we have in our brain that a neuron is fired. But here it's very hard to draw this picture because we have continuous numbers. But kind of the analogy is the same because some, in some cases we could have like this weight very large compared to the others. So in somehow you could interpret one neuron as something that would fire more than the other neurons. Okay, does that make sense?
That makes sense, cool. Yeah.
Do you have to normalize your input so they all have the same sort of dimension scale?
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, so this is something actually that's done in the literature of machine learning. So there's a notion called layer like input normalization, which is very important, that allows to like speed up the training.
One input could totally dominate the circuit if it's,
yeah, so you could, for instance,
larger.
Yeah, so for instance, if you have like an input like x1 that's equal to 100 and x2 equal to 0.2, or it's a good idea to have like a normalized scale. Like you could normalize all these numbers between 0 and 1 so that your architecture would like you, so that you don't have to like do a lot of hyperparameter tuning. So we will not do this in this course, but it's good that you highlighted this point. It's a good idea to think about how you could normalize your data before using it into the neural network. Okay, so just to comment here on the different objects that we have here. So we have here an activation function that I'm gonna clarify more later on. So that is called, so those are called weights. And those are called biases. Okay, so, and we will see how these weights and biases will change as we're doing a back propagation that would allow us to learn these parameters. Okay, so if that's clear, let me now move on to how we can define a vectorized format of this equation that's very helpful when we want to implement these architectures. So if we gather the values of all these neurons in one vector, so what we can do is define the following vector, AL, which has all the values of the neurons in that layer. So one thing we could observe from the notation that I've clarified there is that if we consider the vector of the neurons at the last layer, that's basically going to be a function of the inputs x, and f would be the function that's defined by all these layers that we have in the middle, okay? So that's one thing we could see from this vectorized equation. And another thing we could see is that if we want to connect the vector at the lth layer with the vector at the previous layer, then what we could see from this picture is that A, L minus 1 will be multiplied with the weight matrix. So now we're going to drop the indices so that we have a vectorized formulation. B will become a vector. And here we will have like an activation function that is applied element-wise on this vector. Okay, so we're gonna apply it on element-wise. Okay. Is it clear for you what I mean by element-wise application of the activation function? Okay, sounds good. Okay, so you can see that this vectorized formulation is actually simpler than this complicated equation. And this is the implementation, how it's done in the PyTorch package in particular, because this vectorized format is actually faster to evaluate because you can actually parallelize the computation compared to this notation here, this equation over there. Okay. So now if I promise you to give you examples of this activation functions, so this is what I'm going to do right now. So I'm going to provide examples of activation functions. So one possible activation function we could define is the one that's biologically inspired, which is the, like a, yeah, go ahead.
Do the weight matrix W and the bias vector B depend on L and L minus 1? Like they're different for each.
Yeah, could you say that again? Yeah.
Do W and B depend on L and L minus 1?
Yeah, indeed. Like, so if we were, for instance, to, like, decide what's the dimension of W and B, that will clearly depend on the size of the previous layer and the current layer. So can you, for instance, guess? Yeah, so that's actually very good because I actually forgot this index over there. So thank you for the observation. So if we want to denote what the size, if we want to, can someone like figure out what would be the size of this weight matrix based on this equation here for consistency? Let's start with a bias because it's simpler. What do you think would be the size of the bias?
NL.
Exactly, yeah, so that would be NL. Now what about the size of the weight matrix?
NL minus 1.
Exactly, yeah. So NL minus 1 times NL. So NL minus 1 will be contracted with the dimension of AL minus 1, and we will end up with NL at the end, okay? Yeah, very good point. So the first, going back here, the first activation function that could be used is the so-called perceptron. The step function, which is used in the so-called perceptron architectures that were historically developed in the literature a few decades ago. So we can define this function as eta z, where eta z could be defined in the following format. So for values that are negative, we could have values that are zero. And for values that are positive, we could have values that are equal to one. Okay, so it's a step function from zero to one, decided based on the sign of each input z. Okay, so can anyone tell me, like, what would be the disadvantage of using this architecture when we're going to try to learn the parameters using gradient descent? Can anyone see? Yeah.
The function is not continuous.
Yeah, can you say that again? Yeah.
The function is not continuous.
So. Exactly. The function is not continuous and it's not differentiable. So the gradient here is zero, and the gradient here is zero, and here, close to zero, that's explodes. So it's not something that will allow us to learn using continuous gradient descent. So clearly we need other choices of activation functions. So this will motivate the second choice, which is the one we've seen in logistic regression. So the sigmoid. So that's sigma z defined as 1 over 1 plus the exponential of minus z. So as we've seen last time, so the values of this function are positive and are bounded between 0 and 1. And in the middle, we have 1/2. So it's something that goes like this. So it goes asymptotically to 1 for large values of z. And for very negative values of z, it goes asymptotically to 0. And in the middle, we have something that goes as that's close to 1/2. Okay. Another example we could take is the hyperbolic tangents. So, as you know, that's defined as the exponential of z, exponential of minus the exponential of minus z, over the exponential of z plus the exponential of minus z. And as you already know, that this function is bounded between minus 1 and minus 1. For large values of z, that saturates at 1, and for negative, very small negative values of z, that saturates in minus 1, and we have a transition regime here close to in the neighborhood of 0. Okay? So those are possible choices. There are also other choices of activation functions that are not bounded. So one famous choice of non-bounded activation functions is the so-called rectified linear unit, also known in the literature as ReLU. Okay, ReLU. And that's defined as the maximum between 0 and z. Okay, so it's actually that very simple, and that looks something like that. So for positive values of z, then this output will give us just a linear function z, and for negative values of z, we will have all the values be, the outputs will be basically zero. So, go ahead.
I have two questions. First, because the tangentiation is just a deformation of the sigmoid, then why we have to?
It's, as you've mentioned, it's just like some variation of the sigmoid. So the sigmoid would be very useful if you want to have an output that can be interpreted as a probability, which is because that's something that's defined between 0 and 1. The tangent, hyperbolic tangent is could be useful if you want to like have outputs between minus 1 and 1, which could be relevant to some applications. So it depends on the different types of applications. And ReLU is also helpful if you want to have unbounded like outputs, so that could be helpful. And it turns out that in the recent few years, ReLU is actually provides better performances for unknown reasons compared to bounded activation, nonlinear activation functions. So this is something that you will explore in the tutorial next week. All I wanted to highlight here is that those are examples of activation functions that are famous in the machine learning community and that you can try on your experiments. Okay? Yeah.
Why is it advantageous that it be zero if it's less than, if Zn is less than zero? Why not just say, use the identity function and have done?
Everywhere?
Yeah, just have a straight line everywhere.
A very good point, yeah.
Single negative or single positive?
Yeah, that's a very good point, yeah. So if we define like this activation function as the identity, then the following the following thing will happen. So you will have this output at the layer L will depend linearly on the previous output in the previous layer. Sorry. So in that sense, it's actually a linear relationship. And if you try to, you see here that this is kind of a recursion relation, and if you expand it, you'll be able to do just linear algebra. So you'll just, it's something that's easy, to evaluate at the end. And it will not provide you with some nonlinear dependencies between your variables. So you'll end up with a linear decision boundary at the end, similarly to the logistic regression. So this is key. Thank you for highlighting this point. It's important that this activation function, that it's nonlinear. For instance, here, the nonlinearity comes when we go from the identity to zero for negative values. And this is kind of like part of the learning. It's saying that for negative values, we're going to forget about them. We're going to output zero for those values and only keep the values that are positive. So it's similar in spirit to this step function, but It's also something that can be differentiable for large values, for positive values of z. Yeah.
The fact that it's not differentiable at zero cause a problem?
Yeah, so this is like a very fine Tuned case, like that you have z equal to zero in practice. Generically, that's not an issue, like that it's not differentiable here. Typically the values that we can get are still, like for instance, very close to zero, but not exactly zero, like either positive near zero or negative near zero. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Now another choice of activation functions, so that's the fifth one. So that's an extension of the ReLU. It's called the exponential linear unit. So also called LU. So the similarity to the ReLU, we will have Z for when Z is positive, but now when Z is negative, we're going to assign this specific function. So what this does is the following. So you will have the identity for positive values of Z, but for negative values of Z, you'll have something that goes as an exponential behavior that's where this alpha tunes like the value that you get in the asymptotic limit. So in that sense, it's something that's differentiable everywhere with some hyperparameter alpha that you can tune, and where alpha is something that's positive. So that's also a very famous choice of activation functions that's used in the literature. Okay. Yeah.
So compare the performance between the IRLU and this.
Yeah, it's very hard to judge, like to say 100% that this is better than the other. It's actually varies from one application to the other. Because of the nonlinearities, it's actually very hard to open the black box and say, well, this nonlinear activation will be better than the other. It's actually about experiment with all these choices and seeing what would be best. So all these choices are actually called hyperparameters that you can use to design your architecture. Okay. Another one last type of activation functions is the so-called softmax activation. So that's used typically at the output layer. So given some input z, where z is like a vector z1, z2 until znl, and l is capital is the number, is the index of the last layer. So that is defined. So the index I of this application of the softmax is defined as the exponential of zi over the sum of all the elements and of the vector of the exponential of zi. Okay, so this is the motivation behind using that, is that if you sum over all the components of this softmax, if you define this as some sort of vi, then the sum of all the vi's will be equal to 1. Well, let me write it as pi. And because we have this, then we can interpret pi as a probability of a certain class. So this is why we use it at the output layer, because it provides a normalized output. Okay, and this is also what motivates what's called the notion of one-hot encoding. which clarifies like why do we have like labels that are multidimensional instead of just numbers. So if you're given like if you have like a binary classification where you have two classes, either 0 or 1, so what it's a generally a good idea to transform these binary like variables into what's called like a one-hot encoding. So for instance, what we can do is define labels y as a vector where we can define 0 as the vector 1, 0, and 1 as the vector 0, 1. Okay? So in that case, 1 means that there's 100% probability that this is class 0. And 0, this is like 0% probability that this is class 1. And same thing for here. We have 100% accuracy probability that this is class 1 and 0% probability that this is class 0. And basically, this matches with the output of the neural network because each number pi here of the softmax will provide us about the confidence of each value the confidence about each class of the inputs that we fed into the architecture. Okay, so for the interest of time, I'm going to skip the comments about the expressivity of neural networks. So like you can check those out in the lecture notes. But one quick comment I want to make is that if you have like a feedforward neural network with one hidden layer, and also one output layer, you can like there is a theorem in a theorem where that you can show where if you have a nonlinear activation function in the hidden layer, you can show that you can approximate any functions that you want with some arbitrary accuracy. And there is a caveat there because the theorem requires that you define an arbitrary number of hidden units in the middle in the hidden layer. So I encourage you to read the lecture notes for more details. But what I wanted to talk about at the end is the choice of cost functions that will be important to train the weights and the biases of the feedforward neural network. So is it okay if I erase here? Okay. Cost functions. So one choice of the cost functions that we could have is the first one called mean squared error that we've seen, for instance, in linear regression. So MSE for abbreviation. So what we're going to do here is try to bring the outputs of the feedforward neural network closer to the labels that we defined here using one-hot encoding. So we're going to try to minimize the distance between the outputs of the neuron at the output layer and the value of the label at the ith index. So similarly to what we have done with linear regression, we're going to define the error between the two as the square difference. And then we're going to sum over all the elements in the output layer. So that's the number of elements is n capital L. And then x is only one data point that we have in our data set. So we need also to sum over all the errors that we accumulate for when we forward all the data points in our in this architecture. So we need to sum over all x's in the data points. And it's also a good idea to take the average as well, so that we avoid like having a very large error for normalization purposes. So this is the first choice of the activate of the cost function. Another choice that we could have is the so-called cross entropy. Also known as CE. So you've seen in the lecture, in the first tutorial, an example of the binary cross entropy. So this is when you have two classes. Generically, you can define this for multiple classes. So so you will have something different than this expression, but that serves the same purpose. So we're going to have y of x times the log of a of l of x. And then again, another term, 1 minus I of x times the log of 1 minus a I of l of x. Okay, so this term will be summed over all I's from 1 to n l. And then we're going to do the same as here. We're going to take the average over all data points in the data set. And here, I want to highlight that there is actually a minus sign over here, okay? And it turns out that if you actually minimize this cost function, then you're actually, you'll be making these outputs gets closer to the labels that we have in our data set. So this is something non-trivial. If you want to show this, I would encourage you to, for instance, show that if you, very quickly here, if you take one simple example here of y and l that don't depend on indices, just numbers, so if you take the derivative of this with respect to a, that would correspond to the case that when this is minimized, so of course this will be a convex function, and at the minimum, the derivative will be zero. And if you set that to zero, then you can show that in that case, a will be equal to y. So this is a simpler case, but for this more complicated case where we have indices, you'll have the same principle as this. Okay. So sorry for going very quick on this. Just for the interest of time, I had to shorten this discussion. But if, in case you have any questions, I encourage you to take a look at the notes. And also feel free to send me an email or if you would like to meet to discuss more about this, okay? So that brings us to the end of this lecture. In the next lecture at 11:30, we will learn more about different gradient descent algorithms. We'll also learn about backpropagation and also about the notion of overfitting that we seen in one of the demos in the last lecture. Okay. Are there any last questions? Yeah.
What happens if one of your data points has got the value 1 in it?
Yeah.
Log of 0.
Very good point. Yeah. So if you see, for example, the choice of the softmax, it's something that, so all the PIs will not be exactly, so one of the PIs will not be exactly 0. See, it might be arbitrarily close to 0, but it will not be exactly 0. That's because of the choice of the activation function. Of course, if we choose some other, we have other choice of activation functions in such a way that this is this like a is equal to 1, then of course we'll have instabilities in the training. But that's a great observation. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Here, that should be C of cost function for the cost entropy. Okay, are there any last questions? Yeah.
The tan hyperbolic and the sigmoid function essentially capture, like, the nature of them is essentially the same, right? I don't see a.
You mean, like, is your question like that?
The sigmoid and the tan hyperbolic? It's just a limit that it's like, it's just stretched, same.
Exactly, yeah. So that's a very good observation, yeah. So, yeah, you can think of sigmoid and tangent as like some smoothing like of the step function so that we can make things differentiable. So it's also important to know that in the asymptotic limits, the gradients are close to 0. So that's why it's always good to initialize your parameters in such a way that your inputs are close to here so that you have strong signal for the gradients. And like the fact that you have gradients close to 0 in the asymptotic limits is what could justify why for instance, activation functions like ReLU, it could work better because if you have very large values of z, then the gradient is still 1. So you still have some good signal when you want to do gradient descent. So this is like an intuitive explanation for why you could see that ReLU is better, but it is not like always the good answer because you have very complicated non-linearities that are very hard to deal with mathematically.
For binary classification, ReLU won't work. Actually, it can, I guess, because it will just stop at 1, right?
Yeah, exactly. And one thing I didn't comment about here is that one-hot encoding also works when you have more than two classes. So you could have, for instance, 0, 1, 2, like, for instance, three classes, and the one-hot encoding of 0 would be 1, 0, 0. One-hot encoding of 1 would be 0, 1, 0. And one-hot encoding of 2 will be 0, 0, 1. And you'll see why it's better to use vectors and then compared to numbers in, I guess, in the next tutorial. So that will explain why it's good to use a vector notation for labels than the number, this notation for the labels. Okay. Other questions? Okay, if not, thanks very much for coming and see you very shortly.